Today I want to talk about Jehovenist sexual ideology. And Jehovah is, of course, the word for the God of the Old Testament. And so Jehovenism is not a term I made up, it's used by another author, but I think it's a good descriptive term for this particular ideology, because the God of the Old Testament gets really offended if anybody violates his rules of living. And so it's like, then it connects to this age of that we've come through in the last 100 years or so of severe sexual repression. And the Jehovenist point of view emphasizes how upset, angry, and so on people become or did become when sex was mentioned or depicted, talked about, or, you know, brought into everyday life or discussion, and the difficulty people had dealing with it. Now, ideology. You know what? Ideology. You may have trouble with that term. So I put it up here, and I connected it to things like other terms that sometimes are used, like worldview. Ideology is basically our understanding of the cosmos. And so it connects ourself to society, and it connects ourself and society to the cosmos, or what ultimate reality is, which I've said God, because sometimes we talk about it that way, or sometimes heaven, sometimes paradise. Or the spiritual realm. It might be one way of looking at it. Now, I'd like a couple of volunteers. Does anybody still have their Bible with them? Okay. I don't need these right now, but why don't you turn to them and sort of put a marker there so they'll be ready. Kevin, could you look up 1 Corinthians 6, 15 to 19? Anna? Would you please look up Leviticus 15? Leviticus, that's near the front of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. And verses 16 to 17, chapter 15, verses 16 to 17. Now, I want to talk about Jehovenist ideology. Now, we've looked at already, especially through Elmer's Bible studies, at some of the worldview that the Hebrews had, or their understanding of the nature of reality, God, themselves, and society. And they seem to be very preoccupied with this discussion or trying to emphasize their particular ideology or point of view. Now, ideologies are made up of, might think of it this way, made up of propositions. And these propositions are statements about the nature of self, society, and God. Now, the Hebrews, if you had to think of some adjectives that typified their viewpoint of the self, society, and God, it would probably be things like unity, wholeness, holiness, and those two words I think are connected somewhat, and especially perfection. The strive for perfection, purification of self, of society, and which reflects their understanding of God or God's realm. So, do you see that the understanding of God and God's realm is supposed to be mirrored in our society? how we organize and run our society, and also mirrored in ourselves, so that the society is mirrored in ourselves. Our self is mirrored in society. These are connected through the fact that even though they're separate, we think of them as self, society, God or heaven, paradise or whatever. They have, or are supposed to have, the same structure. And that structure is a striving for purification, for holiness, wholeness, and that everything is a unity and fits together. Now, what I wanted to talk about first then today is how sex got associated with dirt in this ideology, the particular one, the Jehovenist ideology. And that, to understand why sex is associated with dirt, is not enough, because we still have to understand why sex is such a threat. Why is dirt such a threat? Might be another way of looking at it. Now, in any system of classification or ideology, there are going to be things left over, things that don't fit, inconsistencies or contradictions. There's no ideology. Can you think of any other ideologies, by the way, that that you might think that are structurally the same, or when, the way that I'm talking about Hebrew ideology? Any other ideologies that account for the nature of self, society, and the cosmos?
I think the Orientals kind of have a concept of it's very unique. Worship ancestors, so they kind of identify themselves more closely with their relatives and see themselves then as part of a society more fully integrated than we would, less individual.
Okay. It's very important, I think, in the contrast to what you're saying, to see that the Hebrew ideology sees the self as an entity, you know, that can be purified in and of itself and is separated from other selves. Maybe this is what I'm going to try to get at, why sex is such a threat, because it bridges or breaks into this isolation or this unity of the self. But I want to build up to that. What I was saying was, within any ideology, another contemporary ideology that competes, for example, Christianity would be an ideology. Communism or Marxism would be an ideology. Well, what part of an ideology would that be? I think there's a broader...
What did you say, Jim?
The Republican Party of this country has its own ideology, and it works within...
Capitalism. That contains ideas about the nature of humans, what society is supposed to be like. And that is reflected in the understandings of heaven and paradise from a capitalist perspective, too. I don't want to go into that today, but that might be something you want to explore on your own. See how an economy, or the way that a society is organized, mirrors some image of heaven or paradise, too. Emile Durkheim, who was a famous French sociologist and Jewish, who lived around the 1900, sort of the middle of his life, made a tremendous breakthrough in his understanding of religion. Religion, he's trying to tie together all the various sorts of religions and classifications of religions that anthropologists have uncovered. And his breakthrough was to understand religion as the ideal projection of society. So what do we really want our society to be like? And that becomes a lot of the propositions of heaven or paradise or this ideal form. So that we see the constant interplay between society as it is and as we'd like it to be, which is the ideal projection of that society. Okay, let's see. See, who had the Leviticus? Is that you? Oh, okay. Chapter 15, verses 16 and 17.
And if a man has an emissionless son, he shall bath his whole body in water and be unclean until the evening. And every garment and every skin on which the semen comes shall be washed with water and be unclean until the evening.
Okay. Any kind of emission, in this case semen, or menstrual blood, or pus from a wound, anything like that that's mentioned that comes out of the body can infect other things. It has to be constantly taken care of and purified through washing, ritual washings, days of separation. You know, a person shall not talk to other people or associate with them for several days. Even in childbirth, there's the contamination of various kinds of fluids that are associated with childbirth means that the woman has to separate herself. In Leviticus, I was talking to Kevin about that the other day, I found that. In Leviticus, it says if the woman gives birth to a male child, she shall separate herself for 7 days, which is like the menstrual period. But if she gives birth to a female child, she has to separate herself for 14 days. Because the female child is associated with dirt, or the female is associated with uncleanness and dirt. So even though that's the influence of patriarchy on the ideology of the Hebrews. So even though the Hebrews, as we've studied so far in our Bible studies, much more so than our present age, look at the body and mind as not separated, but in unity. And so we would think, well, why then do they see these elements of the body as being so dirty? That is taken up later by Greek thought and separated into the mind-body distinction. But for the Hebrews, what the problem is patriarchy. And where do women fit into the scene? And so women there become associated with uncleanness. I wanted to read a section from this book, Embodiment, this author is getting at the same thing I'm trying to say, and I think he probably uses better prose, but or more understandable. Now, the point maybe I skirted over that I wanted to emphasize is that in any ideology or any classification system, there's things that are left over, and they're known as garbage, or things that don't fit, you know, or inconsistencies. Now, you can think about how obvious this is, like our garbage. Here we have the garbologist. That has no place, you know. Now, we try to, here at Holden, give it a place within a system by recycling it and things like that. But there's still going to be elements that don't fit. That what do we do with? How do we get rid of them? How do they make sense? They don't. So we sort of forget about them and we consider them dirty. We don't want to deal with them. They offend us because they offend our classification system or they offend our ideology. And so we forget about them. We don't want to deal with them. A lot of the things that we've discussed in our Bible studies so far have been things like that, you know, that Christians have trouble dealing with because they don't seem to fit in so well, and so we just don't want to talk about them. Or if we do struggle with them, there's a danger, and the danger is that in struggling with those things, they may come to change our whole ideology, and that's a threat. That is a threat not to ourselves, but to our church, to our society, if we're in a unified society like the Hebrews tried to be. Now, the person, Mary Douglas, who's an English anthropologist, was the one who's really credited with pointing this out about primitive peoples and the relationship of garbage or leftovers or what is classified to being a threat or an offense. For example, Douglas observes, there are beliefs that each sex is a danger to the other through contact with sexual fluids. You see, the sexual fluids contaminate the other person. It breaks into that unified or pureness, being contaminated by another individual. Such patterns of sexual danger can be seen to express symmetry or hierarchy. It is implausible to interpret them as expressing something about the actual relations of the sexes. In other words, but we try to do that, you know, we try to say, what is the higher meaning of this? And it's like with a lot of the dietary laws, too, in Leviticus. You know, why don't Jews eat pork? You know, and people have various theories of that. But usually they're trying to make sense out of it in some other way than just a ritual that is fits in with their ideology, their views of the cosmos. Pigs don't fit in to the cosmos or the ideology of the Hebrews. That's why they don't eat pork. Not because pork spoils, it has trichinosis, or, you know, those kinds of things, which we try to say, you know, that pigs are like that. There's materialist arguments, too, about pork that and you see this in New Guinea, where people treat pigs like pets, and they eat the same things that people eat. The argument is that pigs need a different kind of environment than sheep and cattle. They need mud, they eat leftovers of what humans eat. So that if you support pigs, you're taking away from what humans eat. I mean, they're sort of intruding in on the family, and people will starve in order to feed pigs, you know, that kind of thing.
Is that why pigs don't fit in? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. That's just another argument.
But what do you mean by saying that they didn't fit into the human
family? Okay, well, let me read what he says here. In Leviticus, holiness, whatever else it may mean, involves completeness and separation. It means keeping distinct the categories of creation. Holiness requires correct definition and order. See, the good, bad on everything, you know, is a whole system of classification that has to do with what is pure and clean and what is unclean and therefore evil or bad. To be sure, some of the ancient dietary laws were based upon common sense health precautions, but this does not adequately account for all of them. Certain of the unclean animals which ought not to be eaten are those which the Israelites believed did not conform adequately to their appointed class. In other words, so there are those animals that are between classes and are difficult to deal with or classify. They don't have a place in their system. They aren't fish nor fowl kind of thing, but that's too broad. Some of them are. But you can think of things, certain kinds of animals. Australia is filled with them, of animals that don't fit any place in classification systems. So they're a threat to the holiness, the wholeness, or the purification, because they come between categories. Certain of the unclean animals which ought not be eaten are those which the Israelites believed did not conform adequately to their appointed class, or whose class itself went contrary to the intended scheme of the world. Contact with those creatures which were not clearly birds, nor clearly fish, nor clearly four-legged land animals, which a pig is not clearly a four-legged land animal because it lives in mud and it doesn't eat grass totally. It eats other things too. Then disqualified one from approaching the temple. The abominations described in Leviticus were to be scrupulously shunned because the obscure and unclassifiable elements which did not fit the pattern of the cosmos were always threatening to intrude upon order. They were incompatible with holiness and blessing. The threat also extends to those who in some sexual way defy orderly classification. You know, they're supposed to be men and women. Where do transsexuals fit in? Now, or gays, you know, or anybody else that's between, not clearly one or the other. And then in terms of sexual partners, there's people that clearly can be sexual partners. And then there's other people that are in between someplace. Like, obvious cases would be members of our family, blood relations. you know, or other kinds of of people who don't have the status of unqualified, pure, available sexual partners. The threat extends to those who are in some condition of sexual transition, such as a menstruating or pregnant woman. See, the menstruating woman is to be feared and isolated off because she's in a period of transition. She's not healthy, she's healthy. You know, she's in between. Furthermore, the polluting rules are different from moral rules. Pollution rules are unequivocal. They do not deal with a person's moral intentions or with the careful balancing of rights and duties. They pay no attention to the particularities of context. The only question is whether a forbidden contact has taken place. The polluting individual is always in the wrong, regardless of intent or personal responsibility. Simply by having the wrong condition or crossing the classification line, that person has unleashed dangers for others. The danger, see, is that by polluting the self, the whole society could become polluted. You see, because the society is the mirror, you know, you've got to have everybody pure and clean at all times, or else the structure of society itself is diminished or offended against. And then ultimately, of course, and this is over and over again in the Old Testament, you see this, that the condition of the Israeli or the society of Hebrews is an affront to God when it is not pure and holy, because it's supposed to reflect God, the society, in order to be happy, ongoing, abundant, all those things, and blessed by God. Has to reflect the purity of God. Now, this may, you know, I think it has something to do with the burden of being Jewish. And you see, in the musical Fiddler on the Roof, this comes out, you know, about the burden that the Jew carries with this law, with having to always be pure. You're talking about why we Shrove Tuesday, we had pancakes. There's a Jewish ritual too that is before Passover where they have to get rid of all dead or yeasty materials in the house. And that means you have to get rid of wherever yeast is a fungus, isn't it? So you have to get rid of all dirt, you know, scrub all the pans, get all the ashes off them, clean out all the drawers, do a total house clean. forget the corners and under the bed and things like that, but you have to get rid of everything that is not clearly life, that is between the dead and the life. Yeah.
I was seeing that movie earlier, one line in particular having to do with how much leftover garbage we could fit into our society without having it crumble or break, in the line that he used when he just couldn't deal with the fact that this daughter was going to run off and marry a Gentile. It's, no, I can't bend that far. If I bend that far, I'll break.
Yeah. See, if you marry a Gentile, the whole society could just eventually fall, you know, just collapse. And that's why in the movie it's brought out that if his daughter married a Gentile, it was as if she were dead, and he had never had a daughter. He would have to say, I have never had a daughter, you've never been a part of my life. And it's just that clear, because the purification or the holiness is so important. Now, I asked a couple people to read an article by Walter Brueggemann called Reservoirs of Unreason. Jane was one. Who was the other person? Could you give? I was mostly interested in the first part of that article. Let's see. Let's go in alphabetical order.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So Jim,
she took notes on it.
No, I didn't.
Well, why don't you?
What do you want to know?
Mostly, what the author is getting at in the first part of the article, with the incidences that he uses and the way that he explains them.
As I understood it, Bergman is saying that we'd like to think that we act from a basis of being reasonable and rational when a lot of our actions are motivated by what he calls kind of a reservoir of unreason, which is anger and fear and guilt, et cetera, et cetera. He talks about the nuclear threat, about how our way of handling it is by kind of submerging our fear into a sense of numbness and by perpetrating the very thing that we are afraid of by increasing the arms buildup. He talked about another incident in which U.S. Supreme Court justice was beaten by an old man who had kind of come up and attacked him. Who apparently was upset about some other issues. I think he was talking about abortion, busing, et cetera, et cetera. And he was so upset about these particular issues and seeing his own ideology or his sense of the way the world worked kind of falling through the cracks that his way of dealing with it was by picking a physical target, which was the justice who represented kind of that system of his ideology to this.
Yeah, but why did these people react the way they did?
Out of fear.
Okay.
Fear of a collapsing worldview of what they thought the world should be like.
Okay, so he uses various examples of people acting irrationally. Like, obviously, you know, the Supreme Court justice is up giving a speech and a little old man runs up and starts beating on it. It's pretty irrational. But what might be also irrational is our reaction to nuclear warfare, the possibility of that, that we live with it, and that it's so irrational that, so, you know, it's not just our budget, you know, our pocketbook and taxes that go to this thing. It's the best minds in our society given over to this thing. We don't like to think about that, so we repress it, and it comes out in strange ways then, in sort of unreasonable or irrational ways. But it's important to realize that these things, what was the reason the person attacked the Supreme Court justice? Do you remember? Or the reasons?
Never
say
reason. It just said that.
Well, it mentioned the guy's wife. Didn't they ask his wife why he had done that?
The man's wife said that he was a public-spirited, law-abiding citizen with deep respect for public institutions. And I reflected on what is happening in the life and spirit of such a man who deeply respects law and authority and yet who recently assaults a Supreme Court justice. In the first instant, he said it had to do with court actions concerning busing, prayer, and abortion, but underneath, what he did not say and perhaps did not recognize is that his act of passion and unreason had to do with his sense of the disintegration of his world.
Okay. See, now, what I wanted to do is to use that as an illustration of how that's carried over into the severe sexual repression that takes place because it contradicts or it doesn't fit in with our world. Or it didn't. Now, you know, we've changed about, and the people that have the particular point of view, this Jehovenist point of view, no longer really have control over sexual attitudes and beliefs in society, but still we're all infused with that somewhat. The irrational repression of sexuality comes from the fact that it threatens to bring down the whole cosmos if there's a little chink in the armor of the ideology and it can be infected by this by a practice or a point of view, like the acceptance of gays.
Ordaining women.
I've spent some time in Australia, and the Australian Lutheran Church is intimately connected with the Missouri Lutheran Church. And I didn't grow up, you know, as Elmer says, you got to put in your stripes, get your stripes before you start criticizing the Missouri Synod. I didn't. I don't want to criticize them so much, but I can't criticize the Australian Lutheran Church. But over there, you know, I talked to these people, and the first time I asked somebody, well, what do you think about the ordination of women? I never asked the question again. Because they were totally unprepared to even deal with it. Because it isn't just the ordination of women. It's the whole cosmos and meaning of the church that's going to collapse if that is allowed.
Just carry that a bit further. A friend of ours in Papua New Guinea, who was a deaconess but had attended the seminary in Adelaide in Australia, and she was telling how the women at the seminary were not allowed to participate in having their vespers or opening devotions and so on. But the real reason that they weren't allowed to take their turn was because what if these women had even thought that they dared to lead the prayers? And so it was the idea that the women would lead the prayers that was really, you know, shook them to their foundation.
Yeah.
As you said, the whole...
Right. I mean, I saw the wonder on the... You know, as this guy is just vice president of the church there, and I said, you know, like, what about the ordination of women? He got this blank look on his face. You know, and I realized that, boy, you know, they're not even prepared to discuss it. That's the stage that they're at. You know, they're the stage probably where our church was, or where the church in the United States was, not just the Lutheran church, but other denominations too. And where the Catholic church probably is still. That the whole meaning of Catholic, Roman Catholic ideology will tumble and crumble, and the whole church will fall if a woman were ordained as a priest.
I have heard female colleagues say that they have the main problem with other females in the congregation, that it is often women who have problems with a woman in the pulpit. And that tells me something about how integrated that whole structure is, even though the structure has often been repressive of women. They're so integrated in women that,
yeah,
that they also go along with it.
It's how women got to be associated with dirt or uncleanness is, I think, apparent when you look at the severe patriarchy in these ancient societies. And it isn't just Judaism or Christianity, but it's pointed out that around 0 BC and little, you know, time surrounding that is when the world's great ascetic or self-denial religions come into being, like Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, are the five main ones. And they probably are associated somewhat with the structure of society being a patriarchal society, and the attempt to control all thought, actions, and so on. And then the fact that women are a temptation to men, and take them and may change a man around, or change, you know, they a man's sexual desire for a woman may be, or a part of it may be, that this brings home to the man his inability to control himself or to keep himself pure. And that gets at the next thing I wanted to look at, was how, why sex is a threat then. But some of the words we use that are associated with sex and dirt are words like pollution, filth, garbage, trash, slime, smut. A lot of the vice areas of large cities are referred to by those terms. Also places where dirt is found: gutter, sewer, toilet, outhouse, dunghill, barnyard, pigsty. And then animals that are associated with garbage: pigs, which may be another reason that pork is interdicted in the diets of Hebrews. Animals in general, and vermin. I think, you know, again, there's in Leviticus you find all, you know, snakes, vermin, all of these things you're not supposed to eat. And then cleanup drives. You know, there's the other side of it. You know, we're going to clean it. We're going to have a cleanup drive in our city. Drive the prostitutes out. You know, close down the porno houses. And this is an actual quote. Well, it's not an actual quote, but I got this from the Chicago Sun-Times. In Russia, the penalty for lewd exhibitionism is 2 weeks of street cleaning. It's an irony. I don't know whether it's meant to be that. The penalty for lewd exhibitionism in the Soviet Union is 2 weeks of street cleaning. That means showing body parts in public. Now, from the Brueggemann article, what I wanted you to see was how the offense against our ideology or the offense against our views of the cosmos affect our body. They make us sick to our stomach. You know, and you hear people say that. That makes me sick. You know. Or, you know, the idea of people between sexual classifications. Some people are, you know, the idea of gays, you know, what they do. You know, or transsexuals. And it isn't just the sickness. It may be, you know, other emotions that become involved. My son knows a lot, you know, about gays. But it's so clear, you know, it's so funny how even though he's raised in a rather tolerant atmosphere in the Bay Area, and there's gays all around, mm-hmm. and he knows, sees them, you know, and some of his best friends' fathers are gay, and he probably knows that too. He still, because it offends his notions of classification, male, female, you know, mm-hmm. this kind of thing, he reacts himself. You know, when he talks about going over to San Francisco, and he says, "Boy, if one of the, you know, if anybody, one of those gays touched me, boy, I'm gonna get it." This guy about this tall, you know, trying to beat up a gay, you know, and I took some students to San Francisco who were visiting me from Washington, and I took them over to Polk Street in San Francisco, which is sort of the raw center of the gay community, where a lot of the cruising and pickups and, you know, pornography and so on, gay pornography are. And I could see, you know, a couple of these guys, their faces started getting, just walking along the street, their faces started getting red. And they started, you know, their fists started going like this. And which made me think, you know, my response, you know, this guy was saying, "Boy, let one of those guys touch me, you know, or look at me." And I said, my two responses, I said, "Maybe you know how women feel now." I said, and secondly, I said, "Why would you be offended? If you're handsome and you're appealing, isn't that a positive sign?"
Well, why should you assume you're so irresistible? Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But I was looking at the other, you know, right. That was sort of the other side of what I was saying. I said, take pride in the fact that you know you're young and handsome, you know. So it's not just sickness of the stomach, but it's fight, you know, or flight. Sometimes people will run from or repress, and not want to talk about those things. Now, sex itself, I mean, this answer about sex associated with dirt doesn't answer the question itself about what it is about sex that offends. And I wanted to say one thing, too, that a lot of people think that sex is associated with dirt because the genitals are near the anus, you know, or associated with things that have to do with excretion. But see, my point of view, and other scholars too, like Mary Douglas, is that that's not the connection. The connection is that both excrement and sex offend classification systems. Now, the Hebrew understanding of sex, of course, is over and over again mentioned from the very beginnings of the Bible. the two become one flesh. That the purity or the containment of the self is intruded upon through the sexual act. It's because the Hebrews are really tied up in their bodies too. It's literally this way with the exchange of body fluids that take place and the actual insertion of organs and other orifices. But it's also metaphorically true too, or true psychologically, in that during the sex act, there's an exchange of identities that take place. And this, if you've ever, you know, discussed or read about sexual behavior and its meaning, a lot of people point out that it's at the time during the sexual act that ego boundaries are lowered and that the person is open to the identity or the unity with the other individual. And so who or what you have sex with becomes really important in terms of your own identity.
Is that true with the sex act, or is that true with the relationship? I mean, obviously not with prostitutes, that doesn't happen.
Sure, it could. Now, of course...
The prostitutes themselves?
The Jones.
No, I mean, if it has...
Oh, you mean on the prostitute's part?
Yeah. I wouldn't guess that.
Right. I mean, to look at yeah. See, that's why the other day I was talking about erotic reality too. Probably the prostitute doesn't enter into erotic reality, and so they're protected from that lowering of ego boundaries. Obviously, it would have to be. But then again, the prostitute has to make a decision about what kinds of persons they'll take. Will they take people who are crippled and, you know, obviously couldn't find sex any other place? Because they're so ugly, or they have something wrong with their bodies, if they're impure, you know, not whole in one way or another. But to understand this exchange of identities, I wanted to say a couple things first about identity and what identity consists of. Sociologists have pointed out that. In our daily lives, it's difficult to maintain a complete, separate, unified identity from one situation to the next. That modern society fragments our identities, so that as we move from one social situation during the day to another social situation, our identity may change too because of who we are playing, what roles we are playing in that situation, and the way that other people relate to us in that situation. If there's enough of that happens, people begin feeling fragmented. You know, who am I anyway? Or, you know, what is my real identity or myself? Now, for this reason, then, a lot of people may seek out sexual relationships as a kind of therapy in the sense of a reintegration of the self. And the choice of sexual partners then becomes maybe a reflection of what one thinks about oneself, reaffirmation of certain kinds of identities. Or it can be not just a reintegration of self, but an actual exchange and development of a different kind of identity. For example, in Xavier Hollander, who was a madame, pointed out that a lot of men who are very strong and in their daily lives are assertive and dominant and so on, seek out in a sexual relationship the role of being submissive and subdued and taking the role of the individual who's acted upon rather than act. Sadomasochism is sometimes explained this way too, that the people who are really strong in their daily lives play the role of the person who's not dominant but submissive in that relationship. And then vice versa, two people who are really submissive in their daily lives in a sadomasochistic type of relationship, play the role of the dominant in the individual. So what are the components of self? You know, it's difficult to, or the components of identity, it's difficult to break that apart. Physicists can do that with the atom, you know, and look at the parts, but it's difficult to get a self in a Bevatron or a cyclotron or something like that, break it apart and see what comes out. But there are some things that are obviously important to identity. One is gender. So the choice of sex partners has obviously a lot to do with one's own gender identity. And other characteristics of the self, things like nurturance, receptiveness, dominance, submission, which I already mentioned, achievement, vicariousness. Elmer, you came in a little late, but what I'm talking about is why the sexual act itself becomes so threatening within the Hebrew ideology. And what we're talking about is this unification, or the wholeness and the purity of self-society and God, and how the sex can break in, the sexual act can break into that if it's not tightly controlled. So, in the sex act, it's not just, it can be both identity acquisition, in other words, taking elements. There's a song by Mickey Gilley, the country and western singer, about something like, at closing time, all women look like tens. But then there's another part of that song too, you know, that what you wake up the next morning and what that's done to your identity. And so it's not, you know, so it's not, this is part of the identity acquisition and identity exchange and self-renewal of identity. So the Jehovanists are not against sex because of its association with pleasure. Because obviously the Jews had a lot of fun, you know, there were a lot of festivals and feasts, and just look at Jewish culture and you find that they can really have a good time. And the Puritans, you know, there was the first Thanksgiving dinner.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what came after.
But, okay. It's hard to find other things in Puritan life, but clogging, folk dancing. You know. They obviously had good times, you know, or sometimes anyway. But because one's identity can be changed for the worst, and then because of looking at the unity of these elements, the change of one person can come to infect and change the whole society, which then becomes an impure, non-pure situation, and therefore offends in the sight of God. Who has the Corinthians passage?
Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? You can never be. Or do you know that the one who joins himself with a harlot is one with her? For he says the two will become one flesh. But the one who joins himself with the Lord is one with the Spirit with him. Flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own, for you've been bought with price. Therefore glorify God in your body.
Okay.
Where was that from?
1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 to 20.
All right. Do you get a sense of what I've been talking about in that passage there? The sexual relations, see, with the harlot can, in fact, change oneself to the extent that one is denied salvation.
Oh,
not only that, but the person who's going to find herself with a harlot is by the temple, but the harlot isn't. She has no relation with that.
Well, it's connecting oneself, see, with...
According to that.
Well, I think that's one interpretation, yeah. So there's several, now following along with this line, there's several groups in society that need to be especially protected because they are especially innocent. Females, for one. Now, the connection with females to dirt and uncleanness is one side of it. But you see that then the other side you have the virgin. You know, the Vestal virgins are the only ones that can guard the implements of importance religiously in a lot of cultures, unsullied. In other words, women are either harlots or dirty, or they're pure, unadulterated. There's a passage in Judges, I think it is, where God tells the conquering Hebrew armies, look, when you go into this town, kill all the women that have had ever laid with a man. But if they're virgins, take the virgins as your wives. The adultery is very horrendous because it can the exchange of body fluids that take place in adultery can then come to infect the husband. You see, he can be infected through his wife's adultery because of these connections, the connections between these sexual fluids. And we might then say the infection takes place on a psychological level too. Then other innocents. Who are some of the other innocents?
Children.
Yeah, obviously. Notice how the Jehovah's ideology protects children. And you still see that very strongly. I think that's probably the primary motivation of citizen action groups against pornography is to protect children. Don't let children see this stuff. You can infect them and ruin them, ruin their state of purification or innocence. Homosexual teachers are really a threat. See, because they have contact with children. They can infect and change them. Transsexual teachers. There was a case in Alameda, which is a town near, or excuse me, Emeryville, which is a town near Oakland, with a transsexual teacher. Okay. You know, a guy goes home for the summer vacation. Comes back. You know, they have the faculty meeting at the beginning of school. What happened to this guy? Why is somebody else? So the principal fired him, you know, and the justification was they didn't want children to know this, you know, that this could infect or somehow make children think about this or whatever and change them in a fashion that would be irretrievable. Nude beaches are again a kind of threat in this sense. The child molester becomes maybe the worst kind of criminal. In prisons, it's an important secret that has to be kept as to who the child molesters are, because the other prisoners will kill them or, you know, beat them up or in one way or another dehumanize them if it's found out. So the child molesters in many cases have to be separated and isolated, segregated from the rest of the prison community. The child molesters are at the same status as the informers, you know, or the informants. They're an enemy to everybody else. I try to, you know, figure out why this is. Maybe you can too, but I think it has to do with the fact that in prison, you know, it's the sign that one is guilty or somehow has morally contaminated. But the child molester becomes, you know, even the sign or the symbol of something even worse than that, mm-hmm. and that one can purify themselves maybe by harming or hurting the child molester. So, you know, we could go so far as to look at the parts of the body, and you see how the genitals or the lower parts of the body are impure in just the way they look. They may be ugly. There are orifices. There's things that stick out. To look at them is to see this, how they fit or how they work toward breaking into the unity or the purification of self, the purity of self. It reminds people, the genitals remind people of our interconnectedness with other selves and how that may then be a threat. So we have this long history of, I guess somebody went around in the, you know, at some time in history and knocked all the genitals off this Greek statues. Which of course makes people just think about it even more.
Yeah, besides it hurts.
What?
Besides it hurts.
Yeah.
George, maybe another thing that could have threats to nuisance would be the books that certain groups like to go around and ban and take out of the library and forget to return.
Or even leaving sex words out of the dictionary, you know, which was done for a number of years. I can still just, it's hard not to think personally, you know, about these things. But I can remember, you know, looking at National Geographic magazines, sure. and they were our pornography when I was growing up. I grew up in like pre-Playboy times.
Series catalogs.
Playboy was the probably the vehicle for the sexual liberation of men in our society, to make men start to bring the discussion about sexuality among men to the surface. And the book for women in this regard was probably a book by Helen Gurley Brown called Sex and the Single Girl, which brought the discussion of women's sexuality into the public province. So copulation is so bad because its effects can leak out and infect not just the self or the identity of the individual and the purity of the individual, but can infect the society and then eventually the society's relationship to God. So how to control sex? You see this very clearly in the Levitical texts, but in the tradition of the West and most of these other world-denying religions, it's been through marriage. Marriage is the vehicle for controlling sex. Paul, of course, talks about the importance of marriage in this respect. Luther did too. The Vatican does. Immanuel Kant. Most of the great philosophers of the West have who deal with the importance and the necessity of sexual repression see its control in the institution of marriage. Aquinas goes so far not only to point this out in terms of the sexual act, but to say that by pointing out that sex's only legitimate purpose is procreation, means that the effects of sex carry obligations much beyond the sexual act itself, but carry obligations toward the offspring and to care and nurture for the offspring. So the sexual act actually, through the procreation act, controls an individual for probably up to 20 years, the after effects. Kevin and Lisa, I ask you to read the first chapter of James Nelson's book, Between Two Gardens. Nelson is the author of also this book, Embodiment, which I read from earlier.
Is this a later book? Or is this
yes, it's a later book.
You want to recap, kind of?
Yeah, what does he say about the body, spirit? Or just give it, so if you want to, whatever you had,
okay,
your notes written down.
Shoot.
It started out, I think, the setting, what he was trying to say was he was in King's College Cathedral in England, and he found himself sort of overwhelmed with, all at once, a sort of spiritual ecstasy, hunger, and also, maybe through the architecture, the paintings, or whatever, also an erotic sort of ecstasy and hunger, and he sort of experienced this all at once in the midst of this service, was it Christmas Eve or something, and found himself thinking that that was unusual, but that it should be unusual, and that indeed what has happened is that we've somehow split into two gardens the idea of separating our erotic selves from our spiritual selves, and that initially, maybe before the great religions of the world, there wasn't that separation, and sexuality permeated all of spirituality and was sort of seen all in the same symbolic ritualistic overtones. But then we had these religions that relegated sexuality to something that was much more earthy, touchable, or along with it took it out of the everyday life and sort of put it in far away context, just like our spirituality became something out of this world, heavenly, far away. And the third stage kind of society is now trying to bring those two gardens back together, maybe three major stages, and he called the third one sort of the lyricism of life and uniting the sexual and the sacred in the whole person again. There was sexual alienation, he said, came from a spiritual dualism, sort of from the Hellenistic Greek of mind over matter. It also came from the Neoplatonists that sort of envisioned the spirit as a prisoner in the body, and also a patriarchal dualism of man over woman from the Bible. And he had two views of these two gardens. One was sort of an erotic from like the Song of Solomon, a creation spirituality. The other was a sin redemption spirituality, more from the message of the fall and the Garden of Eden story. And one was associated with a split and shame, and one was associated more with equality and glory and creation and all that. And the church, he says, has emphasized sort of leaving the world in worship rather than bringing God to it, and putting salvation sort of on a higher plane than creativity. Also a sort of pit of man versus woman, sensual versus spiritual, individual versus society, soul versus body. And he says it's out of balance. This what needs to happen if there's healing of spirituality, it sort of has to happen along with sexuality, because they're really something tied together, and either heal together or hurt together. And we've been on this balance sin redemption side of the scale rather than including an erotic side of relating to God too. And there are like five key words that he sort of used to describe this erotic side of spirituality in the garden. One was feeling, which includes the capacity to be deeply aroused by open experiences. And he talked about desire in the same way that you desire a lover, you can desire God, and rather than sort of passively in a vessel, that kind of impoverishes an erotic dimension of knowing God. And communion, to go to communion without, I like this idea, it's sort of a commitment and a desire to live and abide and be with and know God, is like coming to a sexual intercourse without a desire for commitment, and it's making an object out of the lover. And incarnation is a statement of God saying indeed he embraces the physical, the body, and became one with it, and still one with it, and it's not a dirty thing at all, but it's something that he inhabits. And compassion is another key word that, because of an erotic garden of spirituality, creation embraces the physical and also leads us to embrace social issues and things like that, which is really tied up in what compassion is.